Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery. And that is why the Machinery Digest exists. A no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and welcome to Idle Chatter. I'm your host, Ray Bohax, the hot rod farmer from New Jersey. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey, even though sadly it appears that each day there are less and less, as there are in so many different parts of the country. But hey, we're still here, we're still farming. The sky is cloudy and some drizzle has fallen. So no seed in the ground here yet on the Bohax farm. Hopefully, God willing, this coming week. It seems that every year I try, like anything, to get my sweet corn crop in the ground the first week in May, and it doesn't look like it is going to happen again this year. So, hey, I guess you just have to be grateful for whatever good Lord gives you, and when it gets in the ground, it gets in the ground, and that's basically it. I can't stress myself out over it, and I know a lot of guys are stressing, and it takes a lot of effort to not stress, as you see the calendar pages fanning like in the old movies, and the seed and the planter is sitting in the shed, and the seed is sitting in the bag. So, but that too will pass. The only thing that my business is a little bit different than yours, or most of you, I should say, because we do have such an eclectic mix of listeners to Idle Chatter, of everything from traditional row crop farmers to dairymen to orchard people, almond farmer, or rice farmer, and everything in between, horticulture people. But, you know, since we grow, as many of you know, and I'm just repeating it for the new audience, is that we grow fresh market sweet corn, and because of that, I do multiple plantings. My ideal is to try to get 10 different plantings and stage them out, but I usually only get 8 or 9 in because I get a late start. And we need, since we are doing fresh market sweet corn, I can't have everything come due at one time. And that brings a whole bunch of different problems that a large row crop operation does not face. You know, it's funny how it is in farming. Like in life, there's always some sort of obstacle, there's always some sort of problem. My problems are different than yours, your problems are different than the guy who grows soybeans or rice or canola, but ultimately we all have challenges. And the challenge with the fresh market sweet corn business side of the aisle is that if it takes 3 or 4 days for that planting or 5 days for that to shoot up out of the ground, if I don't wait for that to see some emergence, then my crop runs into one another. And I only basically have between 8 and 12 hours to market it. So it's a real race. And if you have too much of it come due at one time, you can't market it, or you have to end up basically just giving it away. So you're given that. So let's say if I was to wait 4 to 5 days, let's say 4.5 days between plantings, and I had 10 plantings, then it would be 45 days, calendar days, from when the first planting went in the ground to the last planting. And that brings to you a whole different set of weather conditions. So not only does the soil change, the amount of moisture, the angle of the sun, what have you, but there is a real race going on. And if I could, you know, sometimes I don't get my last planting in until June 30th. And, you know, that particular particular planting sometimes yields pretty good, but that's never my that's never one for the books, because I'm running out of sunlight, running out of heat units, and the days are shorter and what have you. So, like I say, hey, it's a lot of fun, right? I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't love it. So that's it. But those are the challenges. I like to represent that to my audience, because just like I like to learn about the challenges that you have on your farm, that you can't put sweet corn in a bin. So you have to pick it, get it out of the field, and for the flavor to remain as robust as possible, you have to try to get it to market, very quickly, because it does start to convert the sugar to starch, and then nobody really likes that. So oftentimes, I wish I could just put the crop in a bin. And the only bin that you could probably put it in would be some sort of refrigeration, which at this particular point we do not have. So, and that still, slows that conversion process, but it's never as tasty as it is when you first pick it. So it's a, it's a race. It's like transporting a kidney or something. It's a race. We got 8 to 12 hours to get rid of it and move on to the next day in another 8 to 12 hours. But listen, what today's show is going to be about, when I was growing up, I used to hear my mom when she would talk to people, and I was a little kid, and I don't think you hear that saying much anymore. So many of the old sayings in life that were so meaningful and were so representative of things seem to be going by the wayside in the social media world, and it's been replaced with LOL or something else. Well, what's that other thing? BFF, which I don't even know what that is, something about best friends for something forever, who knows. But then they fight the next day, right? But there used to be sayings like a hard road to hoe, walking in high cotton, and what's the other one I was thinking of? But anyway, it was truly represented the struggles of life, and it was a metaphor that really gave a lot of meaning. And today we've lost a lot of that. Thankfully, in the good part of the agricultural community, we haven't lost all of it. But it is, going away and fading away, and a lot of younger people are not familiar with a lot of those old sayings and metaphors for life. But I remember my mother always used to say, when she was talking to someone, another person who was a parent, and she used to say, small kids, small problems, big kids, big problems. And since I was born later in life, in my parents' life, not my life, I wasn't born old, I would hear that quite a bit, because if we went into town and my mother ran to somebody in the supermarket and the other person, the neighbor, would be telling her something that's going on with their children who were 7 or 8 years older than me, and my mother always used to say that. And it is, it is so true that in life things go on, and the bigger the farm, the bigger the problems, right? The smaller the farm, the smaller the problems. And since my wife Charlotte and I do not have any children, we've never had any children, we've had a lot of animals, and we still do have animals, they're our children. But I can say that it's different with animals, because as an animal gets older, they're usually much more sedate and easier to work with, and don't get in as much trouble as a teenager animal does. So I guess it works a little bit differently with that. But, what I'm leading into here is that I like, over the years of going to different farms and talking to different people and just being involved with agriculture and being involved with machinery, not just agricultural machinery, I've spotted a trend. And that being that in a lot of instances, and I'm not going to be say in every instance, you'll have a farmer or a person, if they're not even in farmer, machinery person or car guy or whatever. And so we'll reference it off a farm. It'll be easier, so I don't have to keep stumbling over my words and give you some continuity in this show today. But you'll have a guy, and he takes wonderful, wonderful care of his tractor, wonderful care of his combine, wonderful care. Then as you go further down the food chain of machinery, right, when he gets to his pickup truck, maybe he doesn't take as much good care. When he gets to his UTV, that gets less care than the pickup truck. And then when he gets to the lowly one-cylinder motor, the Briggs & Stratton type air-cooled one-cylinder motor, there is a common thread where most people almost brag about how abusive they are to that engine and how little maintenance they give it. But when it doesn't run right or doesn't start or is giving them some problem, they curse like a drunken sailor, forgetting about the fact that they neglected it. So what today's show is going to be all about are how to avoid big problems with small engines. Now keep in mind that oftentimes the smallest aspect of a piece of machinery or the smallest piece of machinery will very easily sideline a 10,000-acre operation, a 5,000, any operation, a 10-acre operation. So, for instance, let's say that you use a seed tender, and the engine on the seed tender, and you're trying to get beans in the ground, and the engine on the seed tender doesn't run right. Well, your whole operation, you just fill the seed tender up, you're out in the field with it, you got the planter there, you got the tractor there, you're looking up at the sky, and the sky is blue today, but on the weather, say, they say it's going to rain tomorrow, and if you could get these acres covered and get those beans in the ground, and what happens is the seed tender engine doesn't run, or gives you a problem, or runs and stalls. Okay, let's say that you have an engine on a fluid transfer pump. You're pumping water into a sprayer, you're pumping liquid fertilizer, and whatever you're pumping into it, and you have a problem with that engine. All right, the whole operation comes to a screeching halt because you cannot, that little engine, that $200 engine is bringing this big farm, this big ranch, down to its knees and putting you far behind. On the same token, let's say you have a problem with your chainsaw. You're out in the field and a tree falls down at the end of the field. You need to cut it out. Chainsaw doesn't start. So you know, you could see where I'm coming from, that many, many successful operations or lose a good deal of time or lose the optimum planting window, and we all know about that optimal planting window. That's basically what's causing a lot of stress with the weather most places in the country are having so far in May. But anyway, we know that smallest thing could bring a whole just bring it to a grinding halt. And sadly, if anyone remembers back to I believe it was 1986 when the space shuttle exploded on launch in Florida. And as an aside to that, I always loved the space program, and it was a source, it still is, such a source of pride for me, American pride. And now that President Trump is bringing back the space, or not bringing back, creating the Space Force as a supplement to the Air Force, I'm really excited. But anyway, back then when I was young and single and had minimal responsibilities, I had contacted NASA, and I actually received tickets to go down. They're free, but you have to apply for them if they were at the time, and to go down and watch, I think it was the Challenger that blew up, to watch the launch of the space shuttle. And something came up in business. I was working for the oscilloscope and emissions analyzer company at the time, and I don't know, something came up, and I could not end up going to that launch. And thankfully, you know, God works in, you know, people say mysterious ways, but it's not mysterious. It's mysterious to us. It's not mysterious to Him, because He has our best interests at heart. And thankfully, I did not go there and watch that and see the devastation firsthand. But if you recall back to that horrific event, it was an O-ring that caused that disaster. Then that whole program just was black-eyed from that, and those people lost their lives, and there was nothing good about it. But the only thing that I would say, and for lack of better terms, is to say what was good about it is that if we heed that and we say yes, that the small things, the details do make the difference, that an O-ring was the cause of the fuel leak that resulted in the explosion of the spacecraft, and neglecting or not being familiar with a small engine can not blow up your farm, but certainly blow up your profits. And we do not want that to happen. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to lecture you first before I start the show, and I'm going to say that you know, please listen to this and pay attention. And if you have to listen to it again, there's really not a lot that you need to do to keep your small engines productive, but it does need to be done. And their importance within your farm operation needs to be recognized. And so many times in life is that it's more an attitude than an actual action, and that you, if you respect and honor the value that that small engine brings to your farm and how important it is. And, you know, I've said this many times before in the show, and you're probably sick of hearing it, that I look at every piece of farm equipment as a like an emergency piece of equipment, like a fire truck or an ambulance or anything like that, is that because it has to run when it has to run. And we need to be able to have that small engine running when we have to put it to work. And the bad part about small engines is that they most times they're not used every day. They may not be used only a couple of times a year. I mean, on a seed tender, during planting, you're going to use it, and you're not going to use it afterwards. So that is the basis of our show today. And interestingly enough, I've been wanting to do this show for a little while now, and I do have a letter for our special deliveries segment, which is at the end, where I respond to people's letters to me, to the website and to the podcast. And as you all know, special delivery is brought to you by Firestone Ag, Harvey Firestone's company, the farmer who decided to make tires, right? But this is from a gentleman in Oklahoma, and he's having some issues with an older Kawasaki Mule ATV or UTV, I guess UTV you would call it, utility vehicle, not all-terrain vehicle. And so that'll be at the end of the show, and it's very apropos that we're having that today. But I guess it's not that apropos because it came in the other day, and I knew I wanted to do the show, so I saved it for this. You ready? So what we're going to do is we're going to get talking about small engines, big problems, and hopefully small engines, no problems, after you get done listening to today's podcast. You know, as I was saying, some people brag about how they abuse or the lack of maintenance that they give to this small engine. And they go, well, that thing still runs, and they go like that. And, you know, back years ago, the Chrysler Slant 6, and the older audience that is listening to me will know what the Chrysler Slant 6 is, and that was probably one of the greatest engines ever made, extremely reliable. I mean, you could basically almost, you know, people would brag and say, I ran this thing out of oil, and it locked up, and I let it cool off, and I put five quarts of oil in it, and it ran, still running fine. And that was really a very well over-engineered engine. And because of that, it was, you know, took so much abuse. And it used to be, you know, people would say, you can't kill a Slant 6. And if somebody did kill that Slant 6, they almost had like a badge of honor. And they'd say, you know, all the people, you know, I can't believe this guy killed a Slant 6. So it would be like someone making plastic rust, right? And rust together, we know it cannot happen. But with the, excuse me, I have to clear my throat. I should have to hit this pause button. So what I'm going to tell you today is that what I'm going to say to you, or instruct you is probably a better word than tell you, is that I'm going to ask you from this point on to give all of your small engines the same respect and level of maintenance and care that you give a brand new combine. Alrighty? Now, just because you could buy an engine for a couple of $100 is not going to do you any good when you're trying to get water into the sprayer and you're 8,000 acres from the shop, and the shop is 20 miles from town, and you don't know whether to even have the engine that you need. And plus, you know, as I always say on this show and on my website, it's not the money you make, it's the money you keep. And, you know, why spend $200-$400 and waste so much time to replace an engine, even if you're not jammed up and looking at your wristwatch and saying, I'm trying to beat the clouds into the field, when you could take that money and put it towards something else? And the thing is that all of these, you know, all of these little things is really what makes the farm not profitable. And as I say so many times, we focus on the crop price. And there's obviously a lot of importance on the crop price and on the crop yield. But all of the best prices in the world and the best yield in the world are you're still going to suffer financial losses if you don't have efficient machinery and a minimal amount of repairs. And, you know, I feel that it's, and not because I'm coming from the machinery side, but I feel that it's almost impossible to have a continually successful, profitable operation, farm, ranch, horticulture, what have you, if you have excessive machinery failures and machinery downtime. So I don't see how that model could work, even if you had great, great, great prices and great yield. And then the end result, so you have great prices and great yield, and you have nothing left in the bank because you had so many machine failures. So let's talk about small engines. And I'm going to break this down into no particular, I'm going to break it into a number of areas, but no particular order is what I want to say. Is that the first thing that you need to realize is that most small engines use a rope start. Now, some larger small engines in some applications have a electric start. And why that is important is that we have to understand how a carburetor functions. And most of these engines, if not other than possibly in some sort of UTV or some other application, are carbureted and not fuel injected. Now, a carburetor works on a pressure differential between atmosphere and the low pressure region, which you would call vacuum. People call it vacuum, but it's really a vacuum is any pressure less than atmospheric. And the pumping action of the piston is what causes the low pressure region in the carburetor. And then what will happen is that even though in the industry, say, the carburetor pulls fuel, all right, so it actually pushes and pulls because there's atmospheric pressure on the float bowl, which is starting to push the fuel, and then the piston creating the low pressure area, you could basically say that it pulls the fuel through the booster or through the parts of the carburetor to get the fuel into the engine, all right? So it's actually the high pressure pushing to the low pressure, but you could kind of make a partially convincing argument to say it pulls fuel. And within the community, the engine community will use that term, say, oh, the carburetor is not pulling fuel, all right? But it's really a pressure differential, not pulling. So why am I explaining this to you? Because the velocity, the piston speed, which in turn means the crankshaft speed, the velocity of the piston is going to be paramount in creating the low pressure region for the carburetor to start to pull fuel. And for that reason, most small engines that have electric start are less problematic in starting because the cranking motor, the electric cranking motor, turns the crankshaft faster than you would with the rope start. The rope start basically has a quick rate of acceleration, and then the speed of the piston as the rope starts to extend further out, it almost gives it what they call a jerk rate. And so the jerk rate is very high because the piston, when you pull the rope and it engages, gives a quick shot down, and then the speed of the piston actually ramps off. So now, what will happen is that if you do not have a good cranking speed for the piston, or the crankshaft, we'll say, you don't have good RPM on the crankshaft, that the piston will not create a strong enough low pressure region, and the carburetor will not pull fuel. And if it does pull fuel, it will dribble it instead of breaking up the molecules. Now, a carburetor has a job of doing two things. It's going to, as far as the fuel is concerned, I'm not talking about throttle or choke or what have you, is that a carburetor has the job of first atomizing the fuel, which means breaking it into small particles but still in liquid form. And then emulsifying the fuel means mixing those broken particles. Think of a molecule of fuel like a rock, and you're hitting a rock with a hammer. You're breaking it into small pieces, right? So you're breaking this bigger rock into small pieces. So the fuel droplet needs to be torn, and it needs to be broken into small pieces, and that happens in the carburetor Venturi, usually depending upon the carburetor style. A lot of small engines have crude carburetors, but in some sort of booster or booster Venturi passage, and it breaks that fuel. It actually tears it and breaks into small particles, like an aerosol can sprays, breaks the liquid into small particles, and then it mixes it with air, which is called emulsification. And if you do not have a strong enough signal, you will actually dribble the fuel into the Venturi, the throat of the carburetor. And that dribbling would be like a leaky nozzle tip on a sprayer. It's just dripping. So it's not being broken down into small particles, and it's not being mixed with air because it's one large mass. And then the third aspect, which the carburetor has nothing to do with, but is implicit in it, or complicit, I should say, in it. I always use those terms backwards, but is that there needs to be a phase change of the fuel, and that's from a liquid to a gas. Gaseous meaning a rarefied form, and has to be a phase change because liquid fuel does not burn. So to back up here, the job of the carburetor is to break the fuel into small particles and mix it with air, and then the so it could phase change, and the phase change happens through what is called the latent heat of vaporization. And in this use, latent means unseen. So the unseen heat that causes vaporization of the fuel. So it changes from a liquid in small particles mixed with air. All right, it needs to be emulsified, mixed with air, so there's more surface area, little particles, so it could phase change latently through heat, unseen heat, so it becomes a gaseous form, a vapor, a rarefied form, and that is what ignites. So the first thing is that if you don't have good velocity of the piston and you can't get this piston to go fast enough on with the rope start for a number of reasons, you are probably going to dribble the fuel. You're not going to atomize it, and then ultimately it's not going to emulsify or vaporize, and this engine does not run, and what is the result is a wet spark plug. Because you're putting raw, wet fuel into the combustion chamber. Now, so the cranking speed is paramount to how the carburetor will shear the fuel and pull the fuel. A very slow or low cranking speed will not allow that to happen. Now, the next thing that comes into play, which works hand in hand with this, is that the carburetor, or the signal, I should say, what we call the signal, the low pressure area. Forget about carburetor, I said that wrong. The low pressure area is going to be dependent, even if you have excellent cranking speed, even with electric starter, excellent cranking speed is going to be dependent upon the valve action, how much the valves open, and how the valves seal against the seat in the cylinder head, and the quality of the cylinder sealing, so the piston rings against the cylinder wall. So if this engine has poor valve action because the valves are not adjusted, and as the valve goes out of adjustment, the amount of lift on the valve usually decreases, so you don't have enough lift, the valve is not opening enough, and or the engine has a poor ring seal against the cylinder wall for a number of reasons. The rings could be worn, the cylinder wall could be glazed over, it could have a lot of piston-to-wall clearance, the cylinder-wall clearance that the motor is worn, is that it will be very, very difficult to start, and then most people blame the carburetor. And a good percentage of the time, it is not the carburetor. So it is either poor cranking speed, valve issues, or piston-to-cylinder-wall issues, poor ring seal. So you're not getting the signal inside to start to pull fuel, or you're pulling just enough fuel to dribble it and not break the fuel apart. So before we move on, think of it this way, is that when an engine does not want to start, we need to pull the spark plug out. And we need to look. If the spark plug is very, very wet at that particular point, it's inconclusive, right? It's very, very wet. Is it very wet because we have an ignition problem and the carburetor is doing a good job of atomizing and emulsifying the fuel, but the spark plug has no arc? Or is it because we are not pulling the fuel properly, we're dribbling it? Right now, if the spark plug is completely dry, like it has no fuel, then that carburetor is not pulling fuel. Is it not pulling fuel because it has a stuck needle valve? And then what you could do is you could tap the carburetor gently with a wrench. If the needle valve is stuck, then it'll fill the bowl up. But keep in mind, once it fills the bowl up, it's still going to have to go through enough piston cycles to pull the fuel through all of the passages of the carburetor. Or is it because the ring seal or the valve seal is so poor that it's not creating enough signal to even pull fuel? So the take-home message here is don't always blame the carburetor. Now, keep in mind with the same theme, it is paramount that you keep that carburetor clean, which is very easy with carburetor cleaner. Also, you keep that air filter clean because you don't want to have a great pressure differential. You don't want to choke the carburetor or because it can't see atmospheric pressure through the plugged air filter. All right, and you want to make sure that all of the passages in that carburetor are clean. You'll see there's air bleeds, what have you. And if you do a good job of cleaning that carburetor with spray carburetor cleaner on a continual basis, you will not have a problem. If you are not getting any fuel, and you say, man, this thing ran 2 weeks ago, I can't believe the ring seal went away 2 weeks ago, then there's probably a very good chance that the carburetor and intake manifold, a lot of these small motors may have the carburetor bolted right to the cylinder head intake runner, or they have a short intake manifold. And if you have a loose carburetor, a loose intake manifold, or a compromised gasket there, it will lose the signal. And unlike a car or truck engine that will usually crank fast enough and will start even with a vacuum leak, a rope start engine and a single piston engine is very hard for it to overcome and almost impossible to overcome any type of vacuum leak or poor seal in that induction path. So make sure that you keep the intake manifold tight, the carburetor to the intake manifold tight, and the carburetor itself, all its fasteners snugged up. Okay? So that's very, very simple to do. 5 minutes, keep after it, and you won't have issues. The thing basically is it's like weeds in the field. You don't want them to grow. You want to use a pre-emerge, right? You don't want them to go and then try to kill them later. That's what happened, 30 years ago, 20 years ago at Roundup, is the guys just said, I don't care, if I let the field get dirty, I'll go in there and I'll kill it. Well, we've learned now that that's really not the best way to do it. We have to use a post-emerge a product as a tool in our toolbox, not rely 100% on it. So you need to keep that carburetor clean and tight. And if you have an issue, the plug is dry, try tapping by that needle valve where the fuel line comes in and just tap that carburetor, because it's very possible that for whatever reason, that needle valve stuck. Because remember, unlike a fuel injection system, a carburetor is constantly exposed to atmosphere because the float bowl needs to have atmospheric pressure on it. Alrighty? Now let's talk about ignition. So let's say we've determined that the fuel side of the engine is fine. On the ignition side, most guys grab the spark plug wire and pull the crank a little bit, see if they get a shock, or they'll take the spark plug out, they'll ground the spark plug next to the cylinder head and pull the rope and see if it has a spark. Alrighty? That is not the proper way to check it. It's a quasi-proper way, because obviously if you have no spark, you have no spark. You're not going to see it jump the gap of the spark plug, or you're not going to get a shock if you're holding it with your finger. But if the guy jumps, he's, oh, I got good spark, right? And we've all said that and had somebody say it. Keep in mind that is does not show, what does not reveal the coil's ability to jump the arc of the, send enough voltage to jump the arc of the spark plug under compression. And that is the big thing. You could have a system that's going to make a spark in atmospheric pressure or give you a heck of a good shot to knock you on your fanny, but it will not have enough juice, no pun intended, enough oats to it, to jump the gap of that spark plug during the compression stroke where the cylinder pressure is high. Now, on any gasoline engine, you must remember that the spark has to jump that gap between the center and the side electrode of that spark plug to be able to start that combustion event, which is actually called an ionization event. And if it doesn't have enough strength in that coil, or that ignition system, I should say, because it could be low voltage, what have you, in a small engine like this, it's a magneto. If it doesn't have enough strength to do that, then that gap will never be jumped, and the spark will find its path easily to ground, or not even jump, because it'll be consumed just trying to get to the spark plug. And remember that the spark plug fires on this type of ignition from the center electrode to the side electrode, and its ground path, because it's DC, is the threads of the spark plug into the cylinder head. Alrighty, so that is, so if you basically have the spark plug is loose, or is not grounding well through the cylinder head is loose, then the fact of the matter is that you will not jump that gap of the spark plug, because the ground path will not allow it. It has to go back to ground. So how do you properly check? You need, next time you're in town, buy a small engine spark plug tester. They're about $8 to $10. Maybe a nicer one is $12. Put it in your toolbox, and it has an alligator clip soldered onto it. All right, it has a porcelain like a spark plug, but what it basically does is have a recessed center electrode, and the amount of recess on that center electrode is calculated to try to simulate the load that would be required for that plug to arc during a compression stroke. So you checking it, and it's very simple, keep in your toolbox, and if it can't jump that gap on that spark tester, then it's not going to jump that gap on the compression at the end of the compression stroke to ignite that mixture. And a lot of guys get led astray with this. They chase their tail, because they think they have spark, and they may not have spark. Recap, so let's think about spark plug needs to be able to be tight and into the cylinder head for that ground path. And the other thing is that the only way for us to confirm whether the ignition system has enough, in the word is potential energy in electronics, potential energy to jump the gap of that spark plug under compression. And that stands for any gasoline engine. You could have a V10 Ford engine in your pickup truck or whatever, and you could have a 2,000 horsepower Hemi, blown Hemi in a drag car. It's got to have enough juice, meaning strength, I'm using it, the slang, to jump that gap of the spark plug under compression. Alrighty? So we went through carburetor, basically fuel delivery. We went through spark plug. Now keep in mind also that the gap on that spark plug is going to be very critical, and you also, most small engines use a 25,000th gap, and you also want to make sure that side electrode is positioned square over the center electrode. Lots of times that'll get bent over, or you buy a new spark plug. Whenever I put new spark plugs in anything, I look at it and I take a pair of needle nose pliers and I tweak it to make that a nice square cut over it. And keep in mind that if you have an older engine and based upon the magneto is going to be, its output is going to be paramount with the cranking speed. That, so you have two things going on: a low cranking speed because the engine is not going to, you're not pulling it fast enough, and on the compression stroke is that you're going to not have the signal in the carburetor and you're going to impact the output of that magneto. Alrighty? Another thing, now a common thing, is that you'll get the engine that starts and runs fine, it doesn't want to take the throttle. It bogs. It idles beautifully and then it bogs. That's usually indicative. It could be fuel delivery, but lots of these smaller engines and have a flame arrestor in the exhaust. And lots of times with carbon, that flame arrestor will get plugged up and it'll be an exhaust restriction. And there's not enough of a restriction at idle. It'll idle beautifully, but when you go to give it throttle, it'll bog. That's many times indicative of not a fuel problem, but an exhaust flow problem. So, yeah, lots of times the flame arrestor is inside the muffler, and you can go in there with a wrench and take it out. You have to look at the engine design. But keep in mind that that's another issue. Restricted exhaust. Most guys go to the carburetor. Sometimes it is, but lots of times it isn't. Alrighty? So, then we need to realize that a lot of them have, for the past 20, 25 years, have a flame arrestor of some sorts in that muffler system, and that is a common problem. Ready? The other thing basically is valve adjustment. Probably no one other than a go-kart racer, all right, adjusts valves on a small engine. And keep in mind that as those valves go out of adjustment, the amount of lift will be decreased because there's more of a gap between the rocker arm or follower, whatever it happens to have on that engine, and that lash between the tip of the valve stem to open it up. So it's got a lot of free play there. So even though the camshaft is moving the rocker the same amount, it's not impacting, its motion is not being transferred to the valve. And if you don't have enough valve lift, intake or exhaust, you're going to impact that signal into the carburetor, and then that engine is going to be very, very hard to start. So you need to keep those valves adjusted, and the manufacturer is usually very good with telling you how often to adjust it. Now, as an aside, I'm going to break away for a second here, is that on all of my small engines, I spend about $25 or $30 when I get them, and I buy a tachometer with an hour meter in it. And they get triggered. There's nothing to hook up. It gets triggered inductively through a spark plug wire. You wrap the wire around there, and you can mount the tachometer with the proof meter with the engine runtime on there. And I like one with a tachometer so I could see what's happening with RPM under load and what have you, and use it as a tool and just basically to know what the RPM is. But you need to look at that hour meter, because lots of times these engines get more hours on them than we think. And we neglect the maintenance because we feel that it didn't run that time. And lots of times it's an eye-opener. You could buy, and I would suggest that you buy one with a replaceable battery. And it uses like a watch-style battery, so that when the battery goes dead a few years from now, that you could change that. And usually they could keep it, it keeps the data in memory as far as the running hours. But, you know, that's very important, because you say, man, I haven't adjusted, if the book calls for adjusting these valves every 50 hours or every 100 hours, you could have 200 hours on this motor and you don't even realize it, and you never adjusted the valves, and you wonder why it's hard to start and that it has no power. The other thing is that keep in mind that these engines have a propensity to build carbon deposits on the valve, on the intake valve. And when you build the carbon deposits on the intake valve, you limit flow through that engine. You do flow throughput. You're choking that engine down. Then again, the signal gets weakened, and also the power of that engine is down. So you say, man, this thing is a dog already. It doesn't want it. It's making no power. Lots of times, it has nothing to do with cylinder seal. It's carbon deposits on the engine. And the best way for you to keep those carbon deposits at bay is from when the engine is new, treat a good portion of the fuel, depending upon how much the engine gets used. If it's like on a seat tender, it doesn't get used much, then I would treat all of the fuel that goes into it with a product like Chevron Techron or something similar to it. But you want something that doesn't say fuel injector cleaner. And notice it's carbureted, but it works fine. You want something that says complete fuel systems cleaner, combustion chamber cleaner. Because a product that is just a fuel injection cleaner, when you put it in that type of application with a carburetor, once it goes through that phase change on an injected engine, what it basically does, it flashes off. It evaporates off at the tip of the pintle of the injector, or it'll flash off in the booster of the Venturi of the carburetor, and I'll use the word soap, it never gets to the intake valve. And if you get the deposits on that intake valve, you will tent them up on that intake valve, that engine will lose majority of its power, and it will lose its signal, and it will be very, very hard to start and run. So that's something, and if you treat that fuel, you will have no issue whatsoever. So let's recap here. We have the carburetor. We want to keep it clean and tight. Alrighty. We want to be concerned with the signal, the circuits in it being clean, and the carburetor to the intake manifold, and the carburetor fastens itself tight. Ignition. It's usually either going to work or not work. If it does become weak and the engine becomes hard starting, then what you want to do is use a spark test to determine that. I also want to add with the carburetor, a lot of small engines over the past number of years, because they changed the emission standards, have had a problem with the vents in the gas cap. And what will happen is that the engine will run fine, you shut it off, it heat soaks. This happens a lot with chainsaws. Or even the motor on a seat tender. It gets hot, you shut it off. It heat soaks, the vapor pressure in the gas tank goes up, and then what happens is the engine gets starved for fuel and doesn't want to restart. It started fine cold, but doesn't want to restart hot. If that is the case, then take the gas cap off, loosen it, and try to start it. You've probably ran the carburetor dry, so it'd be a little bit hard to start. But if that has a problem, it's very, very common with small engines to have a venting problem with the gas cap, and it's usually a problem, a hot restart after we shut off or went to be fueled again. Alrighty? So we have that. We spoke about the exhaust restriction, and that's usually a bog. It'll start and run, but it won't want an RPM. It'll go, bleh! And then you release the throttle, and that's fine. Alright? We spoke about adjusting the valves, carbon deposits on the valve, the importance of cranking speed, using a spark tester, all right? And the other thing that I like to do in all of my small engines, and you're going to think I'm nuts, but I'm the engine guy, right? I love engines, and I use a high-quality synthetic oil in all of my engines. I use Mobil 1. I like it because it's relatively inexpensive. It's a great product. There's other products out there that people will argue are even better. I'm not going to deny that, all right? But it's easy. It's easily obtained. It's relatively inexpensive, and I use Mobil 1 and everything. And the reason why I use Mobil 1 is that I want to have the less friction on the engine when I'm pulling it with the rope start, so I could get higher cranking speed to get that signal going in that booster of the carburetor, and also to get that magneto to give it a powerful ionization voltage across that spark plug. The oil is very excellent as far as keeping the engine clean, and it does an excellent job of not building the carbon deposits on the piston and around the ring package. So if you do all of that, put an hour meter on it with a tack for $25, all right? And do that and take care of it, that engine will start and run, and that little 5 horsepower or 10 horsepower engine will not be bringing your farm to a screeching halt and you cursing like a Christian man should not. So now we're going to be on to our special delivery section, and that is brought to you by Firestone Ag, a company founded by Harvey Firestone, a fourth generation farmer from Columbiana, Ohio. Harvey dreamed of putting rubber tires on farm tractors, and his innovative mindset is the core of Firestone Ag today, and lives on with their 23-degree tread bar and AD2 technology, along with their new Firestone of replacement tracks. The soil is the lifeblood of your farm. Trust it only to Firestone. Well, thank you, Firestone, for allowing me to bring this to my audience. I have a quick letter here. It says, I ranch, and it's from Oscar Belden in Oklahoma. I ranch in Oklahoma and have an older Kawasaki mule. When I go to check the cattle and fences and I let it idle for a few minutes, it starts to blow blue smoke from the exhaust. If I drive it away, it smokes badly for about 200 feet and is fine until and clears out. It is fine until it idles for about 1 to 2 minutes. It runs fine otherwise. Thanks. Okay, basically, I have experience with this, not with a mule, but I had experience with this from when I had my engine shop and built performance engines. I had two engines. It was a 383 small block Chevy and a turbocharged 3.8 Buick V6 and a turbo Trans Am, and they both did the same thing, and under an extended idle condition, they would start to pull oil and smoke. And then you would start to drive it away, let's say, from a stop sign or a traffic light, but it had to be extended idle, as Oscar is saying, with his mule, Kawasaki mule. And it would smoke more and more and more, and then you'd go maybe a couple hundred feet, and then the exhaust would start to clear out, and it was fine. You could drive it on the highway and release the throttle. I had people follow me. There was no signs of visible smoke, only under an extended idle, and it drove me nuts. And what I found in both instances was, believe it or not, it was worn valve stem seals. And the dynamics of the high vacuum, even though you would tend to think that it, you know, on coast down the vacuum is higher, but for some phenomena it did not happen. And these things would, if you let them idle for 5 minutes, they'd smoke like a crop duster, and then you would basically, you'd drive them away and they would start to clear out. By the time you went maybe an eighth of a mile, the exhaust was beautiful and clear. So I would have to say, Oscar, that you have probably worn valve stem seals on that engine and that mule. And you said it's an older one, and the seals probably dry rotted from heat over heat cycles, what we call thermal cycles, and they probably dry rotted from that, and or they lost their flexibility, I'm not looking for the word, the softness to move around, and they may have actually went off the boss that the valve guide is in and rode up on the valve. And that's indicative of it, but I would tend to say that they're probably dried out, because you don't complain of any smoke on startup. But that is only a two-cylinder engine, and if one valve is down and that seal happens to be, if it did ride up, then it happens to be on the guide, it wouldn't leak oil down into the cylinder. But whatever, I would have to say, you know, until you take the valve cover off and look at it, then I would have to say that you probably have nothing more wrong with it than valve seals, and it's just sucking the oil past the valve into the combustion chamber at idle. And it's like I said, I've seen this phenomena. Then subsequently, after I had my shop, I've seen this phenomena a number of times on other engines. I mean, it doesn't happen every day, but I saw it enough to be able to diagnose it accurately. So I don't think you have anything more than that. So check that out and let me know. And keep in mind that it is something that you should take care of, because if you're putting oil into the combustion chamber, you know, we just got done talking about valve deposits. And I know that's an electric start motor, so it's going to be more forgiving because it has a higher cranking speed. But if you are going to keep burning oil, you're going to create a large amount of deposits on the backside of the intake valve, on the piston crown, and down into actually the ring package, or the land of the piston, which is the part of the piston above the rings. So it is something, I mean, you know, if you're in, you're probably at the end of calving season now, but if you're, you could let it go probably to next winter, but the sooner that you could get that fixed is that it'll stop a lot of other problems from the engine, from carbon deposits. So I would definitely not just, you know, take a laissez-faire attitude about it, but I would, check it all out. And it shouldn't be too bad. I don't know the orientation of that engine. And if possible, I would go to Kawasaki and buy their valve seal. But you want to also make sure that when you buy those valve seals, if you buy them from anybody else or Kawasaki, that those seals feel pretty soft and pliable. That was the word I was looking for. I said flexible, pliable, because a lot of this older stuff, and with these small engines, that part could have been laying around for many, many years, because they made that seal 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, and that it's actually not really a rubber, but I'll call it a rubber, and that kind of started to dry out and get hard. It could have been sitting in the sun someplace in the package and in the dealership, and or not even in the sun, but just start to dry out and get hard. And so you want to have that seal has a certain, and that's with any engine when you're putting the valve seals on. I mean, you don't want to get stale valve seals, because you're going to do this job and it's going to be a nightmare. You just have to do it again. Or you can say that hot rod farm, I don't know what he's talking about, because I put new valve seals on it and it's smoking just the same, maybe a little bit better. And, you know, since I have a couple of minutes yet at the end of the show, I do want to say is that if you use on any engine, if you were to take the spark plug out, the gasoline engine, take the spark plug out and put compressed shop air into the cylinder bore to hold the valves up, you want to put the piston atop that center, and you want to put the shop air in to pressurize the valve so that you could take the valve lock retainer and spring off with and not have the valve drop into the cylinder head and change those valve seals. So that is an easy way to do it, and you want to have the piston at top dead center, so in case for some reason the compressor line bursts or whatever, something happens to the air line, that you don't drop the valve too far into the piston. If it's a top dead center, you would still usually be able to fish it out. And what I would also do, if you know, when you're at the dealership, I would buy at least new valve locks, if not a new valve lock and a retainer for each valve, because even though you can reuse them, they are old, and those valve locks have been worn around. The general rule of thumb is to put new locks on an older engine when you take them off and you service the valves in that sense. And there may be a special tool to tap that valve seal down onto that guide. Lots of times you could find a deep socket that will go down and work very well, and you have to gently tap it down. But the most important thing is to well lubricate that guide and that valve stem and that seal as you put it down. You don't want to put it down dry, because you'll either tear it or expand it enough because of the friction when you're tapping it down, that it will not seal properly shortly thereafter. So keep that in mind. And that's with any engine, not just the engine in a mule. I mean, nothing here is application specific to any brand. Well, I want to thank you for listening to the show today. I greatly appreciate any time you listen, and I just want to have a couple of minutes left here. I try to keep the show around an hour, give or take or so. But I'm excited because I am in the midst of doing the road test, and I'm calling her Black Beauty, 2019 F-150 Limited. So that's a fancy schmancy truck, F-150, with the Raptor 450 horsepower drivetrain in it. And I am in the middle of road testing it. And as I said last week, I'm going to do a special road test podcast, and there's going to be an article up on my website. And I called her Black Beauty because she's got such beautiful black paint on her, and she definitely is a beauty. But she's a real country girl. She's not a, even though she's pretty, she ain't afraid to get down and dirty and work. So that's basically that. And then this coming Thursday, which is May 9th, I believe, my buddy Bob Ida is getting his Ford GT, and that's a GT supercar. So it's not the GT Mustang. He's getting his Ford GT. Took a year and a half to get it, and when you buy that car, they deliver it right to wherever you want. So they're delivering it to his shop, and I'm going to go down there with Black Beauty. And Ford has extended my time with the vehicle kindly. And I'm going to get some nice photos from my website, Farm Machinery Digest website, and for the road test article, also of his beautiful brand new white GT juxtaposed against the beautiful black F-150 Limited. And interestingly enough, they both have a 3.5 EcoBoost engine. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of things done to the GT engine, but the in engineering we would say it's got the same DNA, the same architecture, because the GT is rated at 650 horsepower, either 650 or 675, I forgot which, and Black Beauty is rated at 450. And I had her on the dyno, chassis dyno, last week, and you have to wait for the story, the podcast to come out, but I can tell you she's making every bit of that 450 horsepower. And so it's going to be real interesting. I'm excited. He's real excited to get this car, and it's, you know, quite a, quite a great day, and I'm just hoping that the car's not coming till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. God willing, it'd be great if I could get some corn in the ground and then shower and change and get in Black Beauty and run down to his shop, which is about 65 miles away from our farm in South Jersey. So once again, thanks for listening. Thanks for letting me share my excitement about all of this, and I don't want to have any of your farming operations sidelined anymore for a small engine. So small engines, no problems. Not small engines, small problems, or small engines, big problems. And always know that the Hot Rod Farmer is praying for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved America. Thanks again for listening, and I will catch you, God willing, next week.